This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Questions, please contact Ann Shaw at 713-526-4000, extension 303. This is KPFT Houston.
Good morning. Welcome to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. It is just great to be with you on the 11th of June. Where is the year going? It's going so fast. That's the way it is. Where do we start today? It's like loonies coming out of the woodwork. President goes to the Middle East and makes what I thought was a pretty damn good speech. And the loonies can't give him any acknowledgement for the speech on all sides. Government doing, in many ways, some positive things on the economic front, and the loonies continue to backbite the president. I am a defender of the president, not always, but I think generally the president's doing a pretty good job for what is an awfully, awfully large plate of problems. So we're going to do some news today. It's been a long time since I've done just a bunch of news, and I want to do a bunch of news because it's been piling up, and then we'll talk about it. We'll open the phone lines. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. There's just a lot of news. There's so much I don't even know where to start. I guess the first place I'll start is newcapitalshow.com. Please feel free to visit our website. And if you are not on our mailing list, please join our mailing list. You can do that by looking on the right-hand side of the homepage, and there's a place you put your name and your zip code. We like to know the zip code so we know where people live, and your gender. We like to know, we like to make sure that we're appealing to all genders, male, female, and otherwise. So we use that information. We don't use it in any other way, just to make sure that we're doing as good a job as we can. NewCapitalShow.com. Why don't we start with an article? I started taking I used to take the Wall Street Journal only online, and they offered me a deal like a month ago. They said, you're paying $129 right now to get it online. We'll make you a deal. If you pay $99, we'll send it to you in the paper form and online for the next year. In other words, I get the online and the paper bundled for $30 less than I was getting the online only version for. And I asked them, well, what happens at the end of the year if I decide I want to continue that arrangement? Oh, it's going to be $350 at that point if you want to continue. I said, all right, I'll take it. We'll see how it goes. And you know what? I have been reading much more now that I'm getting the paper version. You know, we talk about newspapers going out of business and paper versions going out of business, but I have to tell you, I do a much more thorough job of reading the news when I'm getting a paper version. I don't know about you, but I do. And this caught my eye today. Tamara Audi, spelled like the car, her last name. Las Vegas construction industry faces deeper hit. Amid finance woes on the Las Vegas Strip, the Fontainebleau's... The Fontainebleau's bankruptcy filing puts 3,000 resort project workers at risk. You got that? There are 3,000 workers working to build the Fontainebleau. Right? Just like back in the 1700s, there were probably 3,000 plus workers working to build Versailles. And there is a photo of the Fontainebleau. It is a massive black phallic building. Massive. That was expected to employ 6,000 hotel and casino workers on the Las Vegas Strip. You know, one of these massive, massive things rising out of the American desert. Here are the details from Tamara Audi. The bankruptcy filing Tuesday night by Fontainebleau Las Vegas LLC. LLC, of course, is a limited liability corporation. Right? As we know, there are different ways that entities can form. There are corporations that can be C corporations, where there are multiple shareholders and taxes are paid directly by the corporation to the government. There are S corporations where there can be multiple shareholders, but where the income is passed on to the shareholders themselves and paid by the shareholders. There are limited liability corporations, which are like a hybrid. This is the owner of this project is the Fontainebleau Las Vegas LLC, a $3 billion resort. Let me give you that number again, because we have a tendency to just gloss over. People hear numbers, $3 billion, $3 billion. The $10 billion project, $10 billion project. You know, what I love about what's going on these days is that people are really getting in touch with the meaning of numbers, right? The numbers are flying around so fast and furious these days that people are starting to look up and go, $2 trillion, huh, what is that? How much is that? How much is our total gross domestic product? Well, about $13.5 trillion and falling. So how much is $2 trillion debt or deficit? How much is a $10 trillion debt level? Well, it's almost our entire gross domestic product. How much do we pay teachers? Oh, $80,000 a year. What are the total receipts for the city of Houston? I actually don't know that number. Or Harris County. Don't know that number. Don't know what our county budget is. Don't know what our city budget is. I should know those things, but I don't. Anyway, this is a $3 billion project. $3 billion to put up another massive resort in the middle of Las Vegas. What is Las Vegas? It is a city. Half a century ago, it was a desert outpost focused on entertainment. It is a place where Americans go to entertain themselves and be entertained in many different ways. Most notably, a place where they can come and throw their money away through gaming or gambling in games where most people know the odds are stacked against them in game after game after game. Very few of the games played in Las Vegas are fair games. We didn't have enough of that, so let's spend $3 billion to put another $3 billion another going up on the Las Vegas Strip. It stands to have a harmful impact on a regional construction industry already struggling with unemployment. Let me get this straight. This is Tamara Audi of the Wall Street Journal is telling me that stopping construction and shutting down and bankrupting a $3 billion project to build a massive resort focused on entertaining Americans further by inducing them to come and throw their money away, that's going to have a harmful effect. because it's going to put construction workers out of work in an air in an place already reeling from construction workers being put out of work because investors woke up and said, maybe this isn't going to work out. Maybe the gig's up. Maybe the days of Americans being entertained by throwing their money away, those days, it might be over. Three big projects on the Las Vegas Strip already have been delayed when financing ran out, including Boyd Gaming Corporation's, here's another number, $5 billion Echelon project. I mean, we love the names, right? Echelon. Right, we know the names are meant to instill a feeling in Americans who go there that they have reached the top of the pecking order. They are checking into the echelon. And which echelon is it? It's the top echelon. They're checking into the Fontainebleau, right? The private garden of the king who was beheaded, of course, for being out of touch with his people. Another project delayed, the Las Vegas Sands Corporation condominium towers. Right, condominium towers. If you don't just want to visit Las Vegas, but you really want to put some roots down in the gaming capital of America, well, you can have a condominium there. Let's not forget, of course, that the city of Las Vegas was made feasible by the damming of the Colorado River in the 1920s. Maybe in 30s. No, 30s and 30s. A project, of course, of the New Deal. And another project, the Harrah's Entertainment Inc.'s expansion of Caesar's Palace. Right, Caesar's Palace was not big enough. Caesar's Palace had to get bigger. Billions and billions. And so what do we want to note here? We want to note the enormous amount of money that managers of investment companies, managers of gaming and operating companies, and investors therein were willing to bet on expanding the city of Las Vegas. Not its schools. Of course, what they're going to say is that, you know, the more business and value that gets built there, we assess property taxes, and so it builds the schools. But let me tell you, that's not that's a fraction of the capital, right? For every dollar of capital that goes into the gaming effort, that goes into the echelon effort, you know, 1 or 2 cents may go, 1 cent, half a cent may go into the schooling effort. It would make much more sense to take the dollar itself and put it into the schooling effort or the transportation effort or all the efforts that we know and we talk about on this station as yielding real net economic benefits. It's an outrage. It's an outrage that these people have been put in charge by hook or by crook of the allocation of capital in our society and the decisions that they've made to build monuments to vanity, to wagering. And now, the Wall Street Journal is worried about the loss of jobs for the workers who are building those monuments to vanity. I say good riddance. Couldn't have happened too soon. Lay those workers off and find them something else to build. Let those unfinished projects sitting, burning up in the U.S. desert, let them rot. I don't know, in that climate, they should last forever, right? Like the tombs in Egypt. Let them be preserved in the dry desert air as a model and a sample of the folly that this country engaged in for the last decades. but don't finish them. Don't use my money to finish them. If some other fool wants to put up their money like fools do in Las Vegas every single day, let them do it. Who are the lenders? Bank of America. Bank of America. One of our largest banks. What does it do? It takes the deposits of hardworking people. And then it's sitting on a pile of deposits. And it's supposed to lend that money for worthy projects. People to buy a home. Small businesses to start. And what did Bank of America lend the money to do? To build the Echelon. To build the Fontainebleau. And now they're crying for government assistance. Too big to fail. Deutsche Bank AG, the massive German bank. More than 100 Fontainebleau lenders filed a lawsuit against the group of banks that pulled the $800 million of funding from Fontainebleau. Right? The other lenders who already have their money in are suing banks to come up with the money, saying, you've got to put your money in to finish the Fontainebleau. The banks are saying, sorry. And then, of course, politics enter in. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, a Nevada Democrat, has publicly urged the banks who have pulled their funding to fund the project. Harry Reid should take a principled stand. Harry Reid should stand up and say, we Nevadans cannot build our economy on the gambling away of funds from Americans. As soon as someone comes to me and presents a plan to take the Fontainebleau and convert it into a center of learning, a center of job training, a center of research for alternative energy, a broadcast tower for progressive information and news, I will do all that I can to see that the Fontainebleau is finished. But until then, I cannot argue for its completion. Don't bet on it. Don't bet on those words from Harry Reid. He's too compromised. Much more news. The big article this week that everybody is talking about. Yeah, not everybody. I say that. It's really not fair for me to say that. Not everybody is talking about this article. I was in Dallas this past weekend. My grandmother turned 90. Happy birthday, Grandma. Thank goodness she's not talking about this article. But many people are talking about this article. David Leonhardt of the New York Times, who has done terrific work over the course of this economic crisis, his column is called Economic Scene, and he writes what to me is an indispensable column. It is a bird's eye view, large overviews of economic issues that attempt to get us to see the big picture. In other words, David Leonhardt does what I do, but he does it much better than I do. I promise you he does. And so, whenever David Leonhardt has something that is worthy of attention, I try to bring it to your attention. America's sea of red ink was years in the making. Most emailed article in the New York Times, David Leonhardt was on Charlie Rose last night, and it's an important article. And he says from the outset of this article, there are two basic truths about the enormous deficits that the federal government will run in the coming years. The first is that President Obama's agenda, ambitious as it may be, is responsible for only a sliver of the deficits, despite what many of his Republican critics are saying. The second is that Mr. Obama does not have a realistic plan for eliminating the deficit, despite what his advisors have suggested. And David Leonhardt goes on to break down the contributing factors and what percentage they contribute to this ballooning deficit. And in the last few weeks, we have seen the effects of that deficit begin to be manifested in financial markets. Specifically, we have begun to see a rise in mortgage rates. You may recall that the Federal Reserve and the federal government have done an awful lot to bring down mortgage rates so that people could refinance their homes and get out from burdensome mortgages. 30-year mortgages touched down in the 4.5% range a month ago or so, but they are now back over 5%, and what's pushing it there is the market, not the government, meaning the market, the capital markets have now basically wrested control of long-term mortgage rates from the government. And we've seen a rise there. We've seen in the past 2 months a deterioration in the value of the dollar versus other currencies and versus gold and silver. And of course, many have predicted that this would be the case at some point. At least that's where the dynamic is right now. And so, what are the contributors to the deficit that is expected, $1.2 trillion between 2009 and 2012? Our government is going to run a deficit of $1.2 trillion between 2009 and 2012. And what are the contributors? Well, about 35% of it is from the business cycle, right? The downswing in tax receipts caused by the recession. Now, I would argue that the recession was not inevitable, that the business cycle is not inevitable, that business cycles are, in some way, the result of poor investment decisions, people going overboard when prices of assets rise and continuing to throw investment money at investments, at assets, when they are no longer good investments. The next contributor is Bush administration policies. 33% of the deficit from the Bush tax cuts. That's on the reduced revenue side of things, and on the increased spending side of things, the Medicare prescription drug benefit. Of course, we know that was very expensive, heavily lobbied, questionable results. I'm not saying there shouldn't be a drug benefit in this country, but clearly we didn't get any kind of overall health care reform, and we may not. And of course, there were some wars that the Bush administration launched. They cost a little bit too. 33% of that $1.2 trillion deficit attributed to our favorite ex-president, George W. Bush. Twenty percent come from Bush policies. Again, tax cuts. These are tax cuts for households making less than $250,000, and also the Iraq War, Wall Street bailout. 20% are things that the Bush administration instituted in which Obama is continuing. That is to say, there is some continuity in these issues being contributory factors to the deficit. Only 7% comes from the stimulus bill signed by the president, 7%. And only 3% comes from spending on health care, education, energy, and other areas. That is to say, things that I generally believe are excellent investments and that we should be making much more of. You got that? 3%. 3% of this $1.2 trillion deficit. To me, this is a very sad picture. Wouldn't you love it if 75% of this deficit, even though it's a deficit, wouldn't you love it if you heard that 75% of the deficit was coming from healthcare spending, spending on redoing our energy system to make it better, our transportation system to make it better, our education system to make it better? But no. 3%, a recent 3%, put into effect by our new president. And of course, as we know, the Obama administration really doesn't have any silver bullets to eliminate this deficit. Professor Alan Auerbach, I think he's at Stanford, says things will get worse gradually unless they get worse quickly. Either a solution will be put off or foreign lenders will send interest rates higher and create a crisis. David Leonhardt sums up by saying that is the legacy of our trillion-dollar deficits. Erasing them will be one of the great political issues of the coming decade. Friends, there is an intimate link between the decisions that we've made. When I say we, I mean in aggregate, as a nation, to pour money into the Fontainebleau, into the Echelon, into the condominium towers, into the expansion of Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and in the deficits that we are experiencing. It's called crowding out. It is an economic dynamic. It means that when you devote money to a certain thing, by definition, you are crowding out the ability to use that capital for an alternative use. And so, when you make a capital allocation decision, whether in your personal life, whether you are a city official or a state official, a federal official, a company, a farmer, or a nation, you better get it right. You better make sure that what you are investing in is your highest and best use of capital. Because you don't get a do-over with capital. There are no do-overs. Once it's gone, it's gone. And the tragedy is that our country has wonderful, amazing, incredible projects. We have beautiful children waiting to be educated, waiting to be taught music, ecology, mathematics, literature, medicine, physics, broadcasting, journalism, political science. And we have crowded out spending to put up the Fontainebleau. This has been the cause of certainly many of the revolutions in history, many of them violent. Crowding out. We do not have a lot of slack at this point. The country has spent reserves in an orgy of foolishness. We spent it in Las Vegas. We spent it in, well, you know, at the birthday party in Dallas. The papers were full of news of the opening of the new stadium of the Dallas Cowboys. The old one wasn't good enough. I think Texas Stadium was the old one. I have a little nostalgia for the old stadium, I have to admit. I can remember growing up in the 70s and watching, I think it was Pat Summerall in the late afternoon on a Texas twilight eve as the Cowboys played, yes, the Redskins. A truly disrespectful name. And watching this stadium open on top, and I always thought, wow, that's a really big and impressive structure. That's a lot of people fitting in there to watch some football. But somewhere along the way, the people of North Texas decided it wasn't big enough. The temple wasn't big enough. The players weren't being paid enough. The luxury seats weren't posh enough. The restaurants weren't fancy enough. Whatever, I don't know. And apparently the cost of the new Texas Stadium tops $1 billion. And in the meantime, the city of Dallas, the city of Fort Worth, of Irving, all of these cities struggle with the same problems that every urban center in America struggles with. And the players on the right, of course, will blame it on the victims. That's what they're doing. They're coming out of the woodwork. The nuts, the warped, the sad sacks. Rather than understanding that in the aggregate, Americans have made very, very, very poor choices with their capital. Gerald Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, I guess got lucky that he put his project on the board at the top of the boom, because my guess is that it wouldn't have a snowball's chance in hell anymore. And frankly, if you lived in Dallas and you wanted to express your displeasure, you would simply not go and not watch. On Sunday afternoon, on a beautiful November twilight afternoon in Texas, you might take your kids on a walk to the park with a football under your arm and show them how to throw the ball. You might tackle them in a big pile of leaves in a park funded by your fellow citizens, maintained, immaculate, impeccable, a source of pride to you and your city. And then you might go home, and rather than turning on the television and playing the Cowboys, you might read a book, eat dinner together, get back to doing the things that really, really matter. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll start on your call, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. This is the new Capital Show. I am Leo Gold. We will be back in a moment. Just a few more items before we get to the phones. Chrysler, after 42 days in bankruptcy, has emerged from bankruptcy as of yesterday. The Obama administration said it believed that a bankruptcy of a major American car company could be done quickly. And they were right. In 42 days, Chrysler emerged from bankruptcy court with the approval of the court, of the judge. It is now restructured. It is owned 55% by the United Auto Workers Union. I think 20% by Fiat, the Italian car maker that has undergone a renaissance in the past few years through its focus on what? fuel-efficient cars. Fiat will run Chrysler. Fiat did not put a dollar and has not put a dollar, and I don't think will put a dollar at this point, it's not envisioned, into Chrysler. Fiat gained control of Chrysler because there was no other partner who was willing to take on Chrysler. What does that mean, essentially? What it means is that Fiat, through Fiat's investments in clean automobiles, in fuel-efficient automobiles, not only did Fiat benefit from increasing its own sales, but the value of that investment extended to its ability to take over the operations of Chrysler. We on Pacifica and KPFT have been talking for years. Years and years about the need to make these cars. We're not auto executives. We should have been. Chrysler wouldn't have gone bankrupt. And so the Obama administration looked around and said, whoever is going to take over Chrysler is going to have some technology that can help Chrysler get there fast. Where is there? There is making cars that people now want. And, of course, gasoline, right, in the plummet last year, gasoline plummeted along with all other commodities. It's back, $2.50 and rising. Oil hit $72 a barrel yesterday. We all knew, you know, $35 a barrel oil was not going to last. Nobody thought that. Hell, I went out and bought oil futures at $35 a barrel. Yeah, that was good. That's worked out. And so, Chrysler is now run by Fiat. Fiat owns 20% of the company. I think it has the right to acquire up to 35%. And the remainder is owned by the U.S. and I think Canadian governments as well. 42 days, Chrysler is now unbankrupt, not bankrupt. Another article, real quick. Next test, value of $125,000 a year teachers. What kind of teachers could a school get if it paid them $125,000 a year? Alyssa Gutman of the New York Times, about a week ago, June 5th, reports that a school could get an accomplished violinist who infuses her music lessons with the neuroscience of why one needs to practice. A self-described explorer from Arizona who spent 3 decades honing her craft at private, urban, and rural schools, 2 with Ivy League degrees, and Joe Carbone, a phys ed teacher who has the most unusual resume of the bunch. He worked as Kobe Bryant's personal trainer. His resume reads, I developed Kobe from 185 pounds to 225 pounds of pure muscle over 8 years. They are the members of an 8-teacher dream team, lured to an innovative charter school that will open in Washington Heights in September, with salaries that would make most teachers drop their chalk and swoon, $125,000 a year, nearly twice as much as the average New York City public school teacher earns. The school is called the Equity Project and is premised on the theory that excellent teachers are the critical ingredient for success. Of course they are. I would like to see teachers paid much more than they are. We will get many more excellent teachers. But you know what? We will not be able to pay teachers if we crowd out teacher pay with monuments to vanity and foolishness in the Las Vegas desert. Let's go to the phones. First up is going to be Guy. Guys, I promise Guy he would be... Hang on, I'm trying to get to the keyboard here. I promise Guy he'd be first up last week, and so he will be. Guy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Leo. It's so great to listen to what you've got to say, and I just wanted to chime in on a couple of things. First of all, the media acts like nobody knew this recession was coming. I want to talk about LaRouche. The LaRouche people send me magazines all the time predicting this issue down to the month. I mean, exactly the way it was going to happen, almost a year in advance. And so I want to understand how come the main media doesn't carry LaRouche, and even the progressive media doesn't care anything about LaRouche. And second of all, the point I was going about last week was that they were saying that the people making $48 an hour were the one that brought down GM, but wasn't it the CEOs that make $9,000 a minute?
Okay. First on LaRouche, I don't have an answer for you. I really don't know a lot about the LaRouche organization. I understand that they're kind of viewed dimly in many quarters, but as far as I'm concerned, a group should be evaluated on the power of its ideas. And if LaRouche and LaRouche's followers have been on top of the economic issues as they have played, if they have advocated against the enormous debts and foolish spending that have gone on in America, then I say we share beliefs in that regard. So that's it. I mean, we need to look at the ideas, not who's who or what they label themselves. And so I would agree with that. If they have held those viewpoints, I just don't know enough about their viewpoints. I should know more, but I don't, and I'm sorry to say that. On the car industry, I think there's no question, as I said last week, that I think primary accountability for the plight of the car companies is held by the executives of the car companies. The unions also bear some significant responsibility. I think that is the case. I don't think they bear primary responsibility, but I think they bear significant responsibility. And again, you just have to look at the fact that Fiat is taking over control of Chrysler, and Fiat was in not very good shape. Guy, I'm going to hang up because you're making a little noise back there, and I'll continue to make my comments.
Okay? I apologize.
Thanks, no problem. Thanks for the call. Fiat is taking, the proof is that Fiat is taking over Chrysler without putting in any money. And what that means is that the power of Fiat's technology, more than Fiat's money, is what has proven decisive in the takeover of Chrysler, in the emergence of Chrysler from bankruptcy. If it was a matter of money, if the federal government looked at Chrysler and said what Fiat lacks right now is money more than anything, and of course, I'm sorry, Chrysler lacks his money, then it would be a question of who's going to put up the money. Of course, the government's putting up the money. But what has been critical in the Chrysler deal is that Chrysler, when the government got in there, and of course, the government could be wrong, but this is the government's analysis, and specifically the team put in by Barack Obama, led by Stephen Ratner and a guy named Bloom, David Bloom, I think. Their evaluation is that what Chrysler's got to have to be able to make it is better cars, better technology, newer technology. We got to get that for them somewhere. And of course, companies are not willing to just hand over technology. They spend decades honing it. Fiat was not in very good shape a decade ago. Fiat remade itself. How did it do it? By making fuel-efficient, smaller cars that appealed to people and would be purchased by people. Okay, let's take Don. Don, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hey, Leo, how you doing?
Great.
I just heard you mention something about the Dallas, this humongous buildings for sport venues being built all around the city.
Yeah.
And I think sometime you mentioned that, and you took quite some beating of it when you talked about the Toyota Center, and you talked about Reliant Energy Center, and now the Dynamo wants their own investments that won't really have any effect on the city, other than paying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Although they claim they're going to create jobs, and if you go and investigate, there's about 200 jobs that pay over below $40,000, so it doesn't make any sense. But anyway, my point is, with all the deficit you're talking about, and fairly understand there are good deals for homes going out right now that otherwise could not be affordable to a lot of people, what do you think, what is the advice that you can give to somebody who wants to buy maybe a $250,000 house, and what do you think the taxes in this city are going to be in the future? Regarding this, what is it called, home mortgage finance rates and all this, to cover all this mess that has taken place and all the money that has been printed, what do you think is going to be the effect in about 5 years' time from now in relation to taxes and home mortgage finance rates?
Okay, Don.
Thank you.
I'm going to hang up and I'll answer off the air here. I'm not on the air, but off the line, okay?
All right.
Thanks. Okay. These are great questions. And I would say, as regards to home ownership, and this is what I do tell people, do not spend more than you can afford on a home. I understand the innate desire on the part of most humans to own their own dwelling. I get it. I own my own home. I enjoy my home. But do not overspend on a home. And the same issues of crowding out that occur at the national level also occur in your personal financial budget. If you have children or some other project that's very important to you, like the education of your children or a new business that you want to start, and those projects require capital, and Lord knows it's expensive to send children to college or to start a new business, but these are very, very high return projects. Studies show that a college education is a good investment, very good investment. That starting a business in which you have passion and skill, that's a very good investment. Houses, on the other hand, are just okay investments. Right? I mean, what's so special about a house? People went nuts in the last 10 years thinking that a house is the greatest investment ever. Why? Common sense would tell you that a business that's going to produce cash and serve customers and grow is going to be a better investment than a house. Educating your children so that they can become who they are, achieve excellence in an area that they are uniquely suited to, is going to yield a higher return than a house. So, if you have other projects that are going to require capital that you are going to put into a house, and you will not be able to do those projects if you put the money into the house, whether through a down payment or through higher interest payments, mortgage payments, or through the need to renovate the house and fix the house on a regular basis, which you do not need to do when you rent a house, when you rent a dwelling, my advice to you is to pursue the same thing that I'm recommending that the nation pursue, your highest, best project with your capital. If you have unlimited amounts of capital and you've got plenty to meet your high returning projects and plenty to meet a house, fine, buy the house, Don. But if you don't and your finances are constrained, it is imperative that you prioritize use of your financial capital. In which case, you would be better off renting. Let someone else put their capital into the ownership and upkeep of the structure. You preserve your capital for your projects and pay rent. And that's simply the best way to go about it. The other question, what's going to happen? I can't remember exactly how Don asked, but it's very simple. If those who finance the U.S. deficit and debts get nervous and decide that those holdings are riskier than they were previously thought to be, they're going to demand a higher interest rate. And that is going to cause higher interest rates for U.S. treasuries. And that's already happening. And it's going to cause a deterioration in the condition of the dollar, which is the currency.
Cutting me off the air.
Okay, next up, let's take David. David, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Yeah, I first wanted to start off by saying the issue that I hear all the time, and this goes right back to what you were talking about, people keep on talking about the term democracy whenever they describe this country. That's a misnomer, because democracy is rightly called the tyranny of the majority. The founding fathers, when they wrote the Declaration of Independence, they said, government derives its just powers by the consent of the governed. Mussolini said, fascism is the merger of fascism can be rightly defined as the merger of corporate and state power. There's a statement, I think James Madison said, you can have a republic or you can have an empire, but you can't have both. That's the issue, is republic. Another statement goes to the effect that in order for an empire to be born, a republic must die. Now, I will ask you this question. What's the difference between a republic and an empire? One easy answer I will give, it's the difference between a citizen and a subject. The citizen has rights, the subject has none. When you are a subject, you are completely at the behest of the rulers. And in an empire, there are nothing but rulers and subjects. In a republic, there are citizens. Citizens have rights. The problem we have in this system is they're trying to convert it into an empire and are doing everything in their power.
They being who, David?
The people who have the power in this country, namely the bankers and the people who have all the money. They're trying to persuade the rest of the people in this country to go along with the philosophy of empire. And this is what you watch all these reality shows on TV, and basically what the philosophy behind them is, it's every man for himself instead of we're all in this together. And who does that mentality and philosophy suit better than anyone? It suits the rich, because they're most equipped to compete in a system like that. The poor aren't. They're the ones who are going to get swept away in that kind of system.
David, thanks. Thanks for the comments. I think that what's most troubling right now to me is that there have been a number of proposals made by the president and I think as well that have gained sponsorship in the Congress. Let's take the bill to create carbon credits, which basically is a way to tax carbon, and anyone who has been listening to this show for a while knows that I am absolutely in favor of taxing carbon, because carbon should be taxed, because its effects, as we know, are not nothing. And already the effort to sell those credits and enforce purchase of those credits by organizations like power companies, perhaps automobile companies, and so forth, industrial businesses, that those credits, at least in the initial days of this bill, will not even have to be purchased, you know, for the next decade. At a time when the U.S. government requires funding, those who are in power, to echo David's comments, those who are in power are going to fight back with all they've got, everywhere you see it, to fix the healthcare system, the doctors and the insurers. Those who are moneyed interests are going to fight back with everything they've got. They will not. They're going to fight back against any kind of marginal increase in their responsibility to the country. The industrial companies are going to fight back against carbon credits, against any kind of marginal effect. And so the president has a very, very difficult job right now. You know, I don't know how we're going to get rid of these deficits. You know, we've still got hedge fund and private equity fund promoters who, granted, are not nearly making the money that they were making before, but they are still taxed at a rate below that of the poorest in our country. On capital that's not even theirs, capital that they basically take a free ride on. Many, many problems, and it's going to take a long time to fix these problems. Which is why it's critical that this radio station be supported. I mean, I thought that coming over to the station today as I was listening to Democracy Now. And I thought, you're just, you know, I'm not starting on a little mini fund drive here. I'm just saying, we talk about how important the station is during fund drive, but I think it's important for me to bring to everybody's attention that outside of fund drive, it's really important. Our voice and other voices like ours. We're going to get there. We're going to make progress, but we've got to keep talking about these issues. And my issue is, how are we allocating capital? Are we sinking precious capital into the desert in Las Vegas for people to go blow their money in an orgy of luxury and high living for a weekend? Or are we going to make better investments? Whether you're liberal or conservative, it seems to me that we could agree that making better investments is critical. And yet conservatives and the right wing in our country are hysterical about the president. They're saying we're becoming socialists. Do you know what the federal government's ownership of U.S. commerce is after all the bailouts and takeovers and so forth? Do you know what that percentage is? 0.2%. But you can turn to Rush's station here in Houston, probably the largest radio station in our area, and you'll hear, we're becoming a socialist nation. You're taking over the country. All the commerce is being owned by Obama. Obama runs the place now. 0.2%. And so they are attempting to foment dissension, and in my opinion, the way they're doing it is treasonous. Let's take one more call. We're almost out of time. David, you'll finish it off today. David, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Appreciate the program. I agree with you that it needs to be supported. A couple things. The Wall Street Journal was reporting the problems with the economy a couple years ago, long before Lyndon LaRouche was involved in it. And he's well known for being a dyed-in-the-wool communist, but that was way back in the inverted yield curves when the Wall Street Journal was producing that. A couple other quick things. The bondholders certainly are going to call the task now. If they're not getting the right money, you're right there. They're going to start demanding higher interest rates. I thought Hebert's article, which really caught my attention, about that we're the only industrialized nation now, that our children have less of a chance to graduate from high school than their parents did. I think those things we need to start thinking about.
Yeah, David, I mean, it shouldn't be that way. Shouldn't be that way. Should not be that way. And I feel comfortable that the new president is focused on these issues. I can't tell you what's going to happen, but I can tell you that those people who are working against those efforts, to me, are verging on treason.
Healthcare went up in Texas 87% from 2000 to 2007. The increase in profits for them were from $2.44 billion to $12.8 billion. They have many reasons not to allow any single payer, any program that would be public.
That's right. David,
but
great to have you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
That does it. We're out of time. www.newcapitalshow.com. I'll be back 1 week from now. Until then, I hope you take care. As always, Laura, thanks to you.
On behalf of everyone at KPFT, we want to send out big thanks to those of you who joined or renewed your membership in last month's fund drive. Your support not only keeps KPFT on the air, but it qualifies you to vote in the upcoming election for the local station board. If you made a pledge in our recent fund drive, please send in your contribution by July 15th in order to be eligible to vote. For membership questions, please call 713-526-4000, extension 314 during regular office hours. Complete voting, nominations, and deadline information is on our website at kpft.org, or you can contact our local election supervisor, Ann Shaw, at election@kpft.org or at 713-526-4000, extension 303. This is KPFT Houston.
We're supposed to wear costumes to the KPFT auction. It's a wear that funky costume kind of thing. Fabulous prizes will be awarded to the most awesome, weird, provocative, strange, ecstatic, unemployed, disastrous moment collage of creativity ever put on the KPFT listener body. If decorating your body isn't enough, you could buy a table and decorate it too. Place elephants, giraffes, gorillas, monkeys, lions, cats, cardboard cutouts, posers, fake pirates, runaway radios, ex-spouses, sod, trees, airplanes, boats, trains, surgeons, giant squids, and useless junk on your table. Eat around it, drink around it, share what it means with you. It may be therapeutic, but probably not. More likely just embarrassing. But if you take the grand prize home, who cares? Saturday evening, July 18th.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.